Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the August 27th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan 13 years ago next month in response to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the war was initially christened Operation Infinite Justice, but in deference to Muslim sensibilities, we were told it would come to be called Operation Enduring Freedom. It was to be Washington's first and last deference to Muslim sensibilities. What both names had in common was that the operation was to be endless, not in pursuit of justice or freedom, but war, infinite war or enduring war, take your pick. And if you look around, it would seem we got what they wanted, and not by chance. Such an outcome is what was contemplated by the six dozen neocons and neoliberals, a who's who of Washington's war hawks, who came together in 1997 as a project for a new American century. They postulated that the ongoing projection of U.S. military power across the globe was a responsibility that every American administration would have no choice but to accept. The first victim of that projected power was to be Iraq. All that was lacking, PNAC's founding document famously asserted, was a Pearl Harbor-like incident that would mobilize a passive American public behind their plans, and by golly, they got it on September 11, 2001. It should be mentioned at this point that 1 year earlier, some of these very same neocons had prepared a similar document for Israeli Prime Minister, the very same Benjamin Netanyahu. They titled it A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm. It called for nullifying the Oslo agreements and breaking off negotiations with the Palestinians. But its first objective? Overthrow Saddam Hussein, and with the election of George W. Bush, three of its authors, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, and David Wormser, received appointments in the Pentagon and set about doing it. That may explain why Paul Wolfowitz, who lobbied long and hard for regime change in Iraq as a Defense Department official years before 9/11, was quick to turn the White House focus from Afghanistan and bin Laden to Iraq and Saddam, despite the fact that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. It was a classic example of bait and switch. Only a handful of historians and journalists have publicly recognized this for what it was and have pointed out that for the neocons, the war in Iraq was not a disaster, but a victory. One of them is journalist and documentary filmmaker J.P. Soteel, who frequently writes for Consortium News, an online website that analyzes U.S. foreign policy in a way you won't find in the New York Times or here on NPR. A week ago today on Consortium News, Soteel wrote, "Neocons do like to declare victory, especially regarding the Iraq War. So it came as no surprise that Paul Wolfowitz, apparently unimpressed by Iraq's mounting crisis, regaled a recent panel discussion at the U.S.-Africa summit with a blunt proclamation, quote, 'We have won it in 2009,' end quote. Some of you may be wondering what Wolfowitz was doing at the U.S.-Africa summit in the first place. That's one of the things that I'll be asking J.P. Soteel when I speak with him at 20 minutes past the hour. Those of you who are so masochistic as to tune into Sunday's TV propaganda's news shows are well aware by now of their devotion to martial music at a time once reserved for prayer. This past Sunday was no exception, and as the online Washington newsletter, The Hill, reports, extending the attack on ISIS to Syria was a key objective. On NBC's Meet the Press, CBS's Face the Nation, CNN's State of the Union, and Fox News Sunday, a parade of Republican legislators led by the ubiquitous John McCain and Lindsey Graham called on President Obama to come up with a plan to defeat ISIS, to do it by attacking it in Syria while preparing for members of ISIS with U.S. or European passports to slip through our airport screeners and commit terrorist acts on American soil. In other words, prepare for endless war. It didn't get any better with a takeaway on Monday morning. First, John Hockenberry, who I ordinarily admire, had Ali Kaderi, a Bush administration insider, an advertiser to five U.S. ambassadors in Iraq, and a former Exxon executive who placed the blame on outgoing Prime Minister Maliki for that country's troubles and the existence of ISIS. Neither host nor guest pointed fingers at the Bush and Cheney administration for launching the war that destabilized the region, or at the Saudis and Qatar for funding and arming the jihadists in Syria, nor at Washington for training many of them in Jordan. Kaderi, too, warned that the jihadists would be bringing the war home to the United States, and for those who didn't get the message or missed the program on Monday, Hockenberry replayed Kadare's statements to that effect on Tuesday. Then on Monday, when Hockenberry brought in as a guest former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, John Herbst, it only got worse. Neither Herbst nor Hockenberry mentioned the ongoing shelling of the eastern Ukraine's largest cities by government forces, which has left at least 2,000 Ukrainian civilians dead, according to U.S. media. To view the damage, it would seem you have to watch RT, the U.S.-based English-language Russian news channel, which can also be found online. The shelling and bombing of Donetsk and Luhansk has also caused several hundred thousand Ukrainians to seek refuge in Russia, which the New York Times' Andrew Kramer has noted often seems more to be targeted on civilians than on the rebel forces. In introducing the segment, Hockenberry commented on reports by Ukrainians that Russian forces had entered Ukraine as if it was an acknowledged fact. We heard the same reports from him today. But in this day and age, when everyone, including soldiers in the field, have cell phones with cameras, why haven't we seen some evidence of this by now? And doesn't the U.S. have satellite photos which would clearly show the incursion? Moreover, in his conversation with the ambassador, Hockenberry assumed that the rebels, or the Russians indirectly, had been responsible for shooting down the Malaysian airline flight MH17 last month that killed 298 people. It was left to Harry Scheer, whose Le Show is broadcast on KCYX on Mondays at midnight, to bring up a key item about the airliner that the mainstream media has conveniently forgotten. What happened to the information about the airliner's downing that was in its black boxes? They were initially found by rebel forces and turned over to the Malaysian authorities, who then curiously turned them over to the British, whose reputation for reliability is almost as shoddy as Washington's when it comes to distinguishing fact from fiction. Now, more than a month after the black boxes, they're actually orange, were examined, all the world has been told is that the findings were consistent with the plane's fuselage being hit multiple times by shrapnel from a missile explosion. The array of holes that were plainly visible on the plane's fuselage could also have been made by the Ukrainian jet fighter that was flying near the doomed aircraft. What the black box data would also reveal is why the plane was diverted from its traditional flight path by Ukrainian air traffic and sent over a war zone, and what was said between the pilots and the air traffic controllers in the minutes before the plane was hit. We will never know that, if it is true, as the BBC reported, citing an Interfax news agency source in Kyiv, that, quote, Ukraine's SBU security service confiscated recordings of conversations between Ukrainian air traffic control officers and the crew of the doomed airliner, end quote. In an interview with Malaysia's New Straits Times, published August 9th, Ukraine's ambassador, Ihor Humeny, denied the story but couldn't account for where the tapes were and why they had not been forwarded to the team investigating the crash. At one point during an interview with the paper, Humeny questioned the significance of the tapes, saying that, quote, it's just the same as the flight data and cockpit voice recorders, end quote. The reference to the confiscated tapes has since been removed from the BBC website. It's not a stretch to say, under the circumstances and given the manner in which the current Ukrainian government came into power, a coup, that the downing of the Malaysian aircraft could quite likely have been a false flag incident. It was clearly designed to escalate sanctions against the Russians, which the Europeans had been resisting, and give NATO an excuse to move its forces right up to Russia's border. And, oh yes, to increase the arms budget of the NATO members, something for which Washington had been pushing for some time without success. Well, yesterday at noon, the latest ceasefire between Israel and Hamas went into effect and seems to be holding. It will not restore the lives of the more than 2,100 Gazans killed by Israeli air and missile strikes, 70% of whom were said by the UN to be civilians, or relieve the pain of the estimated 11,000 who were wounded. Already 3 weeks ago, more than 500,000 Palestinians had been displaced. Now 1.5 million have limited or no access to water supplies. Over 17,000 homes have been totally destroyed or severely damaged, and another 37,000-plus have suffered major or minor damage but still are inhabitable. 26 health facilities have been damaged, and more than 485,000 internally displaced persons are in need of emergency food assistance. But not to worry. Israel, as in the past, will walk away from the death and destruction it has caused without having to pay a dime, except for rebuilding the five UN facilities that were serving as shelters, all of whom which had bombed in the 50 days since the attacks began. Take John Kerry's word for that. It will be the U.S. and its allies in Europe and the Gulf who will foot the bill. Said Kerry, quote, "We are prepared to work with our international partners on a major reconstruction initiative with appropriate measures to ensure that this is for the benefit of the civilian population in Gaza, not Hamas and other terrorist organizations." End quote. And then in one of the most insensitive, obscene statements ever uttered by a U.S. Secretary of State, he stressed that, quote, "Israelis have to be able to live in peace and security without terrorist attacks, without rockets, without tunnels, without sirens going off and families scrambling to bomb shelters. Palestinians, though," he went on, "also need to be able to live in peace and security and have full economic and social opportunities to build better lives for themselves and for their children," end quote. Not a single word from this cowardly scarecrow about Palestinians not having to live in fear of seeing members of their families or themselves blown apart or having their homes and lives destroyed by a trigger-happy Israeli government with weapons provided free of charge by American taxpayers. And why does Kerry not say that? Because he knows deep in his gut that Israel is going to do it again. Well, let's close with three pieces of good news. First, showing some spine or simply resentment at the stream of insulting comments being thrown his way by Netanyahu and other Israeli officials these past months, President Obama turned down, before the ceasefire, an Israeli request for additional Hellfire missiles to use on the people in Gaza, a decision which stunned the Israelis and their supporters in the U.S., who accused Obama of stabbing Israel in the back. With Congress at its August recess, AIPAC had no way of getting it to jump at its command, while Israel's U.S. and U.N. ambassadors pretended it didn't happen. The second piece of welcome news. In response to an ad placed in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post last month that featured spurious statements by well-known Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel that compared Hamas to the Nazis and defended Israel's assault on Gaza, another ad appeared in Saturday's New York Times, signed by 327 Holocaust survivors and descendants of survivors. In part, their letter read, quote, "We are disgusted and outraged by Elie Wiesel's abuse of our history in these pages to justify the unjustifiable, Israel's wholesale effort to destroy Gaza and the murder of more than 2,000 Palestinians, including many hundreds of children. Nothing can justify bombing UN shelters, homes, hospitals, and universities. Nothing can justify depriving people of electricity and water. We must raise our collective voices," the ad went on, "and use our collective power to bring about an end to all forms of racism, including the ongoing genocide of Palestinian people. We call for an immediate end to the siege against and blockade of Gaza. We call for the full economic, cultural, and academic boycott of Israel. Never again must mean never again for anyone," end quote. The full ad, signed by these 327 people, survivors, and descendants of survivors, together with their names and backgrounds, can be found online. Finally, on June 24th, 2010, thousands of protesters at the Port of Oakland prevented an Israeli container ship from the Zim Line from being unloaded in protest against an attack by Israeli commandos on the Turkish ship Mavi Marmara, which killed 9 Turkish activists, one a Turkish American, who were trying to bring building materials into Gaza and break the Israeli siege. It was a one-day protest, and the following morning, the ship was unloaded without incident. That was then. Two Saturdays ago, on August 16th, over 2,000 community and labor activists linking the struggle in Gaza with a protest over the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, prevented another Israeli container ship, the Zim Piraeus, from docking and unloading its cargo at the Port of Oakland. But this time they did it for 4 days. It was a major setback for Israel, and there will be more to come. Using social media and maritime maps readily available on the internet, picket organizers were able to follow the ship's progress and adjust the protest schedule when the Zimline, hoping to avoid an embarrassing confrontation, had the captain delay the ship's arrival from the early morning to late Saturday afternoon. Learning of the change late Friday evening, the organizers used social media and emails to notify picketers to come at 3 p.m. the next day instead of 5 a.m. The longshoremen, members of ILWU Local 10, who've been working without a contract, had already decided not to work that day. On Monday, the protesters declared victory when the Zamperius, unable to offload his containers, pulled up anchor and headed off to Los Angeles. Apparently, it seemed to have his containers unloaded there and shipped by truck to the Bay Area. It turned out to be a ruse. After the ship cleared the Golden Gate Bridge, it quickly turned around and headed back to a berth in another section of the Oakland port. But that information, too, was available online, and so a small group of picketers hurried back to the port to greet it. Even though held back by police lines, they were able to keep the ship from being unloaded until Tuesday night, when longshoremen who had been hired to work on other boats were ordered to unload the Zimperius. A number of them staged a slowdown, and others didn't report back to work after their midnight break. Clearly defeated and well behind schedule, only partially unloaded and unable to pick up any new cargo, the ship weighed anchor Wednesday morning and sailed off under the Golden Gate Bridge to its next stop, Vostochny, a port on Russia's east coast. This time, it didn't turn around. Then this past weekend, two other Zim ships, the Haifa and Chicago, were delayed by protesters in Long Beach, Tacoma, and Seattle. How much these delays and lost shipping caused Zim and Israel's image is difficult to determine, but it's likely to be considerable. Zim ships, which are the major cargo conduit between Israel and apartheid South Africa, arrive every week at West Coast ports, and as you might guess, further pickets are already being planned.